Thank you very much for coming along today. So housing is important to all of us as a place to live. Housing construction has also traditionally been one of the most cyclical parts of the economy. It tends to share this cycle with housing renovation activity and housing turnover. Given the important influences this housing cycle can have on the rest of the economy, say through consumer durable spending, it's easy to see why we pay so much attention to housing as an important driver of economic activity. It is notable then that for the past decade or so, the rate of housing construction has not been particularly cyclical and has been at a low level. Indeed, some indicators suggest that supply has not kept up with demand. There are tentative signs, however, that dwelling investment will pick up, which would in part offset the smaller contribution to growth that is likely to be coming from resource investment over coming years. Today I will discuss what rate housing demand might be growing at and then come back to talk about housing supply before finishing with some general comments about the outlook for dwelling investment. The growth of demand for housing largely depends on the growth in the number of households, which in turn is determined by population growth and changes in the average number of people living in each household. The rate of population growth has been higher over the past 7 years or so than over the preceding few decades. Despite this, the growth rate of the dwelling stock did not increase, and for a few years, the number of dwellings was not growing as fast as the population. Population growth depends on births, deaths, and net immigration. Net immigration depends to a large extent on demographic factors and government policy, but it can also be influenced by economic growth and the cost of housing. The other major determinant to the number of households is the average household size, or equivalently, the household formation rate. Over the 20th century, average household size declined, reflecting increases in income and demographic factors, notably a lower birth rate and an increase in the share of single adult households, either with or without children. However, this long trend decline in average household size came to an end in the early 2000s. Consequently, over the past decade, the number of households has no longer been growing faster than the population. So for a given rate of population growth, we might expect that the demand for housing would seemingly be growing more slowly. But household size doesn't only reflect demographic factors, it can reflect economic factors as well, and in particular, the cost of housing, especially relative to incomes. If housing was less expensive, then young adults might decide to move out of home sooner. We might see that people would decide to live by themselves rather than in a group household, and more people may decide to have a holiday home. As has been well documented, the price of housing increased strongly relative to incomes in the 1990s and into the early 2000s. This largely reflected households' greater ability to borrow, with the decline in nominal interest rates reducing initial mortgage repayments, as well as deregulation and innovation in the financial sector, which improved households' access to credit. While the increase in the cost of housing will have tended to reduce the household formation rate, people's greater access to credit is likely to offset this to some extent as they found it easier to get a loan to purchase a dwelling. The sharp increase in house prices from 1999 through to 2003 is likely to have had a dampening effect on the household formation rates, and so for the demand for housing. We can get some guide to the relative importance of the cost of housing and demographic factors in the levelling off in average household size by looking at the structure of households. A few factors seem to stand out as being important here. First, the number of dependent children in families stopped falling as rapidly, with some increase in fertility rates. Presumably, this didn't reflect the cost of housing. Second, the share in the number of households with two adults living as husband and wife or partner stopped falling. Presumably, this largely reflects social factors, although the cost of housing could have also have been important. And third, the decline in average size of group households levelled off, This is much more likely to reflect the cost of housing. So while we certainly can't be precise, the evidence from household types does suggest that demographic factors were clearly important in average household size levelling off, but that the increase in the cost of housing also seems to have played a role. It's interesting to note that Australia was not alone in experiencing a long-trend decline in average household size, followed by a levelling off in more recent decades. While all of the Anglo-Saxon countries in this graph experienced a run-up in house prices around the turn of the century, there were some differences in the magnitude of this increase and the behaviour of house prices over the preceding decade. So while the levelling off in average household size in these countries may in part be in response to the increase in house prices, it is likely that similar demographic factors have also played a part. Despite the increases in population growth, the levelling off in average household size has meant that the growth in the number of households has been slower since 2000 than in preceding decades. Often analysts calculate a concept called underlying demand, which is said to be the demand for new housing there would have been in the absence of significant changes in price growth for housing. It is the new demand for housing resulting from the growth in the population and the change in average household size attributable to factors other than house prices. But as I outlined earlier, it isn't really possible to distinguish what part of average household size changes is attributable to the demographic factors and how much of it is attributable to the housing costs. Depending on what assumptions are made about this, some basic calculations can suggest that since 2005, new construction and underlying demand have been somewhere between being broadly in balance to there being a shortfall of some 50,000 dwellings per year. However, if we think that there has indeed been a relative shortage of supply over the past decade or so, one puzzle is why house prices have been flat or even declined a little relative to incomes over this period. One possibility is that after the large increases in house prices in the 1990s and early 2000s, there's been a gradual reassessment by households of the fundamental value of housing and their willingness to take on debt to fund that housing. If households have indeed lowered the value they place on housing, but house prices only adjust slowly, in part because of frictions in the housing market, including in supply, this could restrict the rate of new construction. Historically, new construction has tended to increase faster with house price growth, and so an extended period of weak house price growth could be a factor in the limited increase in new housing supply. So why might housing supply have fallen short of underlying demand? One obvious constraint on new construction is the supply of land. Much of the development in cities' inner suburbs is on brownfield sites, the formerly industrial land, and a larger share of this is higher density dwellings. In contrast, new construction in outer suburbs is more likely to be on greenfield land, that is, undeveloped land, and a higher share of this is detached housing. So the supply issues in inner suburbs and outer suburbs are likely to be quite different, and are likely to be different again to those that may affect supply in regional areas. Yet over the past decade or so, the cycle in housing construction has been broadly similar in all of these different areas, with flat or declining construction up to around 2009 in both New South Wales and Victoria, before there has been some pickup. So overall, the cycle of construction in different locations suggest that demand has been a dominant factor in weak construction over the past decade, or that if there are supply constraints, they seem to apply equally to different types of development and locations. A couple of months ago, the Reserve Bank released an article that discussed the supply-side issues in the housing market that our liaison contacts and various public reports have highlighted as being significant. The planning process is typically seen to be complex and have become more so over time. The number of regulations that developers need to comply with has increased, and these have often been administered by different agencies that have not always coordinated well. The provision of funding of infrastructure is also difficult. In the past, governments put in place roads, water and other services and community infrastructure, paying for these out of general revenue. But in recent decades, there's been a move towards user pays, with the developer often responsible for the provision of much of the infrastructure and the upfront cost needing to be incorporated into the development stage. Who ultimately pays for this infrastructure will depend on the substitutability between new dwellings and existing dwellings, how developers profit margins, and how responsive is the price of undeveloped land. The ownership of undeveloped land has also been highlighted as a potential issue in some circumstances. Where the ownership of land on the city fringe is dispersed, say through hobby farms, or equivalently in inner city areas where existing blocks could be used for infill, it can be difficult for developers to negotiate the purchase of a sufficiently large area to make development economically viable. Proposed developments can also attract opposition from existing residents. These objections can take many forms, including increased congestion, a change in the character of an area, environmental issues, or the reduced value of their own homes. Many of these changes, such as in environmental legislation and user pays for infrastructure, have been implemented for social and economic efficiency reasons, and so may be beneficial to society overall. But delays and uncertain timing while infrastructure provision is negotiated or additional regulations or local concerns are addressed are costly for developers. Delays and uncertainty can increase the cost of financing and charges incurred such as rate payments, as well as increasing the required rate of return to compensate for the greater risk involved. Governments at state and local levels have responded to these issues in a range of ways. In some states, there have been centralised authorities established to deal with major new development proposals. A related initiative has been to have a simpler approval process for projects that adhere to a predetermined set of standards. There have also been some measures to release more greenfield land and to cap infrastructure costs. Industry participants report that these various initiatives are having a positive effect, but there remain many complex issues and different views on the appropriate response. Given the difficulties in interpreting housing demand and supply, an alternative and potentially more direct way to examine the tightness of housing supply is to look at the rental market. Some share of properties being vacant is normal as tenants move out and vacancies are advertised, but a high vacancy rate indicates that there are excess dwellings available at the rents being charged, while conversely a low vacancy rate is indicative of a shortage of supply of rental properties. Of course, if there is a shortage of rental properties, then rents will tend to rise faster than otherwise, and so the rate of increase in rents is another indicator of the strength of demand relative to supply. As this graph shows, there's a fairly close relationship over time between the vacancy rate, shown here on an inverted scale, and the increase in rents after we account for inflation. The decline in the vacancy rate and the increase in real rents since the early 2000s indicate that the rental market has been tightening. For the past 7 years or so, real rents have been rising and the vacancy rate has been below its long-run average, suggesting that the rental market has been quite tight. Tightness in the rental market generally will be indicative of tightness in the overall property market. While the typical owner-occupied property will differ to the typical rental property, there is significant interconnection between the markets for owner-occupied and rental properties. Properties that investors could purchase might otherwise be attractive to a first home buyer, while many households rent while waiting to purchase. Also, for some people, the decision of whether to buy or to rent is determined by the relative cost of these and the availability of properties for rent and for sale. Overall, the information on the strength of demand relative to demographic, related to demographic factors and the tightness of the rental market suggests that the rate of new construction has been lower than we might have expected. So it seems an expansion of new construction could easily be accommodated by the market. But what rate of construction might we expect to see in the next few years? The first graph I presented today showed that over the past 15 years or so, the housing stock has grown at a rate of a little above 1.5%, much lower than the rates of 2 to 3% seen in previous decades. Indeed, despite the growth in population, the number of new dwellings constructed each year has cycled between 100,000 and 160,000 since the early 1970s. Given the growth in economic activity, that would suggest that the housing construction has become a smaller part of economic activity. But in fact, new dwelling investment has cycled around a steady range. There are two main reasons why dwelling investment has grown in line with the economy, while the number of dwellings constructed has remained pretty stagnant. First, dwellings have become bigger and better. The average volume of newly constructed dwellings more than doubled from between 1960 and 2010, reflecting increases in both the size and the quality of new dwellings. Construction of larger homes and extensions have led the share of all homes with four or more bedrooms, increasing from 13% in the early 1970s to around one-third now. New construction also uses higher quality materials. For example, the proportion of houses with brick walls rose from 64% in 1994 to around 80% a bit over a decade later. And new dwellings are using higher quality fixtures, including taps, tiles, and so forth. The second contributing factor is that dwelling construction has become comparatively more expensive over time. Since 1970, the cost of dwelling construction has increased by 25% more than generalised prices in the economy, at least in part reflecting the labour intensity of dwelling construction. So while the number of new dwellings constructed each year hasn't grown, the size, quality, and relative cost of each dwelling has. The result is that dwelling investment as a share of total economic activity has cycled around a relatively stable level for several decades. It is difficult to say how these trends may change in coming years, with the exception of noting that homes probably won't continue to get bigger. Growth in the size of detached dwellings has slowed recently and has been a larger share of higher density dwellings, which tend to be smaller. The other part of dwelling investment is alterations and additions to existing dwellings. New construction and renovation activity tend to follow similar cycles, even if the cycle in renovation activity is generally more muted. The factors that drive construction, such as interest rates and house prices, clearly have a big impact on renovation activity as well. The increasing age of the dwelling stock, from a low of 17 years in the early 1980s to around 21 years today, might suggest that renovation activity will increase over time. But other factors, such as the increasing share of higher density homes, are likely to work in the other direction, dampening renovation activity. Another notable feature of dwelling investment since around 2003, and in contrast to the previous decades, has been the absence of a strong cycle. This hasn't only been the absence of a strong upswing, but also that dwelling investment hasn't had any sharp falls over this period that might have been expected. For example, in 2004, when house prices stopped growing rapidly, or in the economic downturn in 2009. In recent years, the share of higher density dwellings in new construction has increased, and this trend would seem likely to continue. This may have ongoing implications for the nature of the construction cycle, given that higher density dwellings take longer from planning through construction to completion. So what is the outlook for dwelling investment? While the long-run decline in the average number of people per household would seem to have tapered off, at least partly related to demographic factors, The strong population growth in recent years and the relatively low rate of dwelling construction suggest that there is sufficient demand in the economy for an expansion in housing construction. The relatively tight conditions in the rental market lead to a similar conclusion. Other factors are also working in favour of an increase in dwelling investment. Interest rates have fallen and income growth has been relatively strong. That said, some factors suggest that the recovery may be relatively modest, including that households have not shown an inclination to take on debt at the same rates as they did in the 1990s and early 2000s. And the ratio of house prices to income is high relative to its history, suggesting that it is unlikely that a large increase in prices is in prospect. So overall, it looks likely that dwelling investment will pick up at a relatively moderate rate in the medium term. How quickly and how strongly, of course, remain important questions for understanding the impact on the overall economy. Thank you.
I've been asked just to paraphrase the questions because we do have some recording here. So I think, if I'm right, it was about the demand for holiday homes and how things in the economy, or interest rates, general economic growth is affecting the demand for holiday housing. John? Yeah.
The rate of holiday home ownership is not going to have a big effect for the macro economy because these tend to be sort of fairly regional effects. Holiday homes are going to be in more specific areas. One of the things that we have seen in the past few years is that post the financial crisis, it was the suburbs that tended to have higher prices that experienced the larger response and the larger falls in their prices, quite possibly reflecting that those people had more financial wealth that received a shock in the financial crisis. And so that potentially has also affected the rate of holiday home ownership. So, you know, there'd be a number of factors going forward that would be very difficult to predict.
Okay, thank you. Next question, there was another one here. Simon? Yep. The question was about rents. I think basically rental yields are lower than what you can get on other investments and certainly lower than mortgage rates. So the level of rents, is that sustainable? Is that right, Simon? Close to?
So one of the things with looking at rental yields is trying to make sure that you're comparing like with the types of properties that are in your house price index and are in the rental index. And so often because, as I mentioned in the speech before, the typical rental property is going to differ to the typical owner-occupied property and to the population of housing as a whole. So if you do try to make the comparison with like-for-like properties, you do end up getting slightly higher rental yields. So they're probably closer to sort of 4.5%, maybe heading up to 5%. But that said, they're obviously still low if you compared them to a much longer history, particularly back to the 1980s or so. But rental yields have been picking up in recent years and are certainly not low relative to their recent past over the past decade or so. So overall, that picture is broadly consistent with the pattern of the rental market tightening, but it does seem that over an extended period of time, there certainly were structural changes with the decline in inflation and nominal interest rates, and so that has influenced things going forward. For where rental yields go to, well, obviously it depends on, you know, benchmarking the return on that as an asset compared to other securities or bank deposits and these sorts of things. So there's a risk difference involved there, but we may well have moved to a world where returns are going to be lower across a range of instruments, and so that may well also affect the relative attractiveness of housing as well.
Okay. Rory, yep.
Rory Robertson, Westpac Group. About 6 weeks ago, I think the Australian Financial Review reported about six times in 6 days the coming house price boom in Australia. My question to the panel is, do we still have time to get in on that? And would the Reserve Bank want to do anything about it, as in either stop it or help it?
As I mentioned in the speech, house prices relative to income are at a relatively high level in Australia compared to their history. as the governor demonstrated in a speech recently, they're not that high compared to a lot of other countries. They're more sort of in the middle of the pack. But so, you know, these house prices relative to income, or house prices in general, can clearly move around over the short term. But over an extended period of time, you wouldn't really expect to see increases in house prices in the same ways that you saw in the late 1990s and early 2000s. So I guess it depends on your expectations whether that's a boom or not.
Back over here, sir. Yep.
I'll ask you a follow-up question. Might work with this apartments. Globally, there's been some examples of locations where house prices have fallen a lot, particularly in the US. But generally, given what we've had with the GFC in the last few years, nominal house prices haven't come off nearly as much as we'd expect in areas where they've been very hard hit. I wonder if you can give a view on why that's not. For instance, in Australia, there have been lots of people expecting house prices to come off a lot.
Well, I mean, there are quite a number of countries and particular regions where house prices did fall quite significantly, and they have pervasive effects through the economy, as we've seen. But in a number of other countries, including Australia, you saw smaller but still nominal falls in prices at a national level, which is still relatively unusual for what we'd seen in the past. So the extent to which you're going to see declines in house prices is going to depend on a range of factors. But certainly in Australia, you would think that the relatively strong performance of the economy, the relatively low pickup in the unemployment rate were important factors there, so that you didn't get a cycle of deleveraging and sales of properties, which were important probably in those markets where you did see large declines in prices.
At the back there, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll just repeat the question because I'm not sure everyone heard. So basically it was a directed Jonathan thing. The RBA's forecast on Friday, 2.75% growth for the next year or so, a little bit in productivity, but a relatively soft labour market over the year ahead. You know, how does that gel with a stronger housing market? I think that's the gist of it, yeah.
Yeah. So certainly we have seen that the leading indicators for the housing, for the labour market have weakened a little bit. So it does appear that employment growth will be a little bit softer. Wouldn't be surprised to see a slight increase in the unemployment rate. And that's what we've outlined in our forecasts. But so productivity growth of late has spiked up. We wouldn't expect to see that strength in productivity growth, but we're still looking at some ongoing productivity growth. But one of the things, so we're not seeing declines in income growth or a significant increase in unemployment. So the strength in earnings and incomes for households is still going to be quite reasonable, and certainly enough that we would think would be sufficient to support a pickup in the housing market and in housing construction. And we're already seeing some signs that that's occurring. So, you know, we do have low interest rates, we have rising rents, rental yields picking up a little bit. And so, you know, these things would suggest that the housing market is relatively tight. And so with low interest rates and the demand there, it would seem that there's the option for supply to pick up and therefore construction to increase at a moderate rate, as we've said. It doesn't seem that you're going to experience a strong pickup in the housing cycle in the ways that you might have in previous decades.
Steve.
Yeah. Stephen Walters, JP Morgan. The Reserve Bank published in their stability review a couple of months ago that piece on the mortgage buffer, that a large number of households with mortgages are quite a long way ahead mm-hmm. of their repayments, and about almost half of them a long way ahead, like up to 2 years. Mm. To what extent do you think that insulates the market from, say, unemployment going up to, say, let's pick a number, 6%? That it might delay any downturn in housing or prevent it altogether.
Yep. I will just repeat that one for the people at the back. The question was about people are a long way ahead on their mortgages. So the RBA published some work in the Financial Stability Review saying that people are using the lower interest rates to prepay their mortgages more quickly, and is that, you know, acting as a buffer for the economy?
John? That's a very interesting point, and it's something that I think a lot of people identify as being quite important in the Australian market, because we have a structure of mortgages that encourages people to make payments, excess payments, and they're not generally penalised under most mortgage products for doing that. And so many people do build up a buffer, and that can provide a very important buffer in case they do experience illness or job loss or these sort of things. So it can be quite an important cushion for the housing market and a reason why you may not see as big an increase in losses and arrears rates if there was a significant downturn. But it's also obviously also important to look at the composition of that and think about that in the case of a downturn. And so whether it is that the people who lose their job in a downturn are also the same people that have a buffer built up. And so that's one of the things that you need to be mindful of in thinking about how effective that cushion will be.
I've actually got a question for both of you as well. And just in terms of the provision of infrastructure and the importance that plays in the housing market, I'm thinking particularly public sector transport as well as telecommunications. So for the outer suburbs of the cities and maybe the regional areas, you know, how important do you think good transport, good communications infrastructure is to the housing market?
You want to go? Okay. clearly it can be quite important. So if you want to be able to have a diverse city, and in Australia we tend to have quite spread out cities, then you obviously do need to be providing the public infrastructure to support that. So particularly if you are going to be developing further greenfield land on the edges of cities, that's something that is important. And it is also important for expansion in existing suburbs as well.
So for Jonathan, I think the first question, what's the greater risk? Was it cutting rates, fueling a boom in house prices, or that you keep cutting rates and nothing happens to housing? You don't get the effect that you're looking for. And then we'll go to Sam's question.
Okay. I think what we've seen so far is that the cuts that the Reserve Bank has delivered, so we've had 5 cuts over the course of a year starting from late last year, are beginning to have an effect and have been having an effect on the economy. These things do take time. And if we look at one cycle in interest rates to another cycle, the effects can be quite different. And so it is always difficult to benchmark how normal the current cycle is. But if we do look at some of those interest-sensitive parts of the economy, then there do seem to be some effects, and certainly we would say that monetary policy is still being effective. Of course, there are some other structural effects that have influenced how the economy is reacting at the moment. For example, consumers seem to be spending at a lower rate than they previously had been. The savings rate has increased. For a large period of time, we had the savings rate declining, which meant that consumption was particularly strong relative to incomes. So that seems to have been an important part of the change in the economic experience this time round. If we think about sort of, is there a risk that a cuts in interest rates could lead to an asset price boom, particularly a housing price boom? That's always something that you would want to be mindful of, particularly because of the effects if that's tied up with an increase in leverage. And we know that cycles in asset prices where there's a rapid growth in credit are potentially more destabilising for the economy. But what we've seen, at least to date, is that households are being much more cautious in their borrowing behaviour, and that the turn in house prices, and if we look at house price growth over the past decade or so, has been really quite moderate. So at least with the behaviour that households are demonstrating at the moment, it wouldn't seem that sort of a cycle is a great concern at the moment or is pending. But it's something that clearly that we and all sorts of other policy makers in the Australian economy would be mindful of and wanting to watch over the coming years.